Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Patriot Education. We're brought to you, as always, through the good offices of a great group of people who truly do believe, as Mr. Cash so ably demonstrated, that they are the nation, just as all of us are. I hope that you will take the opportunity, those of you listening out there, and I know my friends in the chat room will, to visit our site, www.patriotfamilies.com, where you'll get together with people who believe that it only takes one pebble to start an avalanche, and that one voice can change the world. Our topic tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is back to school. What do our kids really need? This week and next week, across the nation, people will be going to their local Walmart, stationery store, Target, Kmart, whatever retail establishment they choose, and filling up their shopping carts with all the school supplies that their first through 12th graders and their college students are going to need for the upcoming academic year. There'll be flash drives and pens and pencil cases and lunch boxes and notebook paper and composition books and rulers and protractors and compasses and anything and everything that they can put in the cart. And most states, well, I don't know whether most states do or not, but my state offers a tax-free school supply month for the majority of August, so that those parents who are stocking their carts for more than one child can basically not have to pay the financial homage to the state of Virginia in order to educate their children, at least not with sales tax. They'll still pay the taxes that pay my salary and all the other folks who teach in our systems through real estate, personal property, and state income tax, but they're being given a quote-unquote tax break in order to encourage them to go and purchase plenty of school supplies so that every child will have an equal opportunity to learn Or is it an equal opportunity to have the very latest sneakers or the super cool new blue jeans or the backpack that looks like whatever superhero is au courant these days? While folks are filling their carts with school supplies, I'd like to take tonight's episode and talk about some of the things that the students, the teachers, the administrators, and the parents need to make sure are present in the individual personal shopping cart of the student entering the school on September whatever. There are plenty of things that our students need when it comes to material items. With our technologically advancing civilization, they need all the accoutrements that go along with their laptop computers or their flash drives or all of the other things, that physical things that are needed to cope with the highly technical aspects of school these days. But there are also some things they need that maybe most people don't think go in a quote-unquote shopping cart. And they'd be right, because many of these things are not purchasable with your favorite plastic or your debit card or the cash that you've been saving up. One of them, which my friend Linda in the chat room mentioned, which would be a great assistance to any student, is a copy of the United States Constitution. And many of those are available for no material outlay through places like the Heritage Foundation and other conservative websites. Some of the other things that our students need to have with them when they walk into those classroom doors, the first thing on the first day of school, are things that are not quite so easy to obtain on the internet. One of them is a desire to learn. And this you can't buy at your local Target or Walmart or office supply store. This is something that has to have been demonstrated and practiced at home. This is something that parents have to provide for their children. Not through the expenditure of credit cards or checking accounts or cash, but through the expenditures of attention, practice, and demonstration. When our kids go to school, are parents sending them as a means of getting them out from under their feet for 7.5 hours a day, or freeing up mom to take a second job, or dad not to have to work overtime, or whatever the reason? Why are they going there? What do their parents tell them is the purpose of school? Are they telling them, you need to get good grades so you'll get a good job and make a lot of money? Well, many of them are. This is not the purpose of education, ladies and gentlemen. It is the outcome of education if the desire to learn is there to begin with. The desire to learn isn't usually engendered by, well, 12, 14 years from now, you'll be rich and be able to work and support a family, and aren't you happy about that when you're 6 or 7 years old? Generally, at 6 or 7, next Christmas is 300 years away, and 13 years down the line, when I'm supporting a family and working 40 hours a week, is totally incomprehensible to a 7-year-old. But the desire to learn is not. The best way to inculcate the desire to learn is to be a lifelong learner yourself. If your children see you paying attention to the news of the day, reading, learning new skills, discussing things with them, not just giving them because I said so as an answer, asking children what they think and listening before you tell them that what they think is stupid or don't talk to me. The things that they need to be able to aim for that hopeful outcome of an education are not adjurations to get good grades so you're going to be rich when you're 25. They are the examples you set them. The examples they see in you of people who value knowledge and learning for its own sake. Because at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13, whatever age, all the way up through the dominion of public school, kids are going to get told over and over and over again by parents, teachers, administrators, counselors, commercials, the president, that the most important thing about an education is its monetary payback when they are an adult. Now, I am not denying, ladies and gentlemen, that there is a monetary payback. But that monetary payback won't come true if mere sitting in a class and playing with your iPad and gossiping about who kissed who on the playground is the main thing you go to school for. Our kids, ladies and gentlemen, are getting very poor examples of what it means to be a lifelong learner. Too many parents are telling them rather than showing them what learning means and why it is important. Another item that should be in the child's quote-unquote shopping cart that you can't purchase at your local Walmart is something called self-respect. Self-respect is not the same as quote-unquote self-esteem, ladies and gentlemen. Our schools, our public schools, are very big about telling parents about how they intend to boost self-esteem. Well, boosting it implies that you have to have some to begin with. All of the practice and all of the sweat and all of the instruction and all of the rah-rah, sis-boom-bah pep talks are not going to turn me into a ballerina if I have no desire or talent for dance. Schools can boost self-esteem, but they cannot create it in your child. Only you can do that. Self-respect cannot be created, okay, in school either. It can be modeled. It can be recognized. It can be acted out of, but created, no. Self-respect engenders self-esteem, ladies and gentlemen. And it is not based on, look at my sneakers, they cost more than yours did, or I've got a cool backpack and you don't, or my mom just spent $300 on my first day of school clothes, and your mom went to Goodwill. That's not self-respect, ladies and gentlemen. What we have, the material aspects of ourselves, the outward appearance of ourselves, is temporary and fleeting and can be taken away from us instantaneously by misfortune, violence, upheaval, disaster, anything that being alive can throw at you out of the blue with no warning. But self-respect is something you can keep. Because what it entails is being true to oneself. Knowing that you're not always right, but neither are you always wrong. Knowing that there are always going to be people who know more about a specific subject than you do. And conversely, there will always be people who know less about it. It is being willing and able to learn from those who know more than you do, and delighted and pleased to give what you know to others if they ask you for it. Self-respect is to understand that you are of value. And as my friend Linda reminds us, that you are a little lower than the angels and a little higher than the beasts. Self-respect is understanding that it is impossible to be perfect, but it is not impossible to be perfectly you. It is impossible to always make the right choice, but it is quite possible to learn from our wrong choices, not to continuously repeat them. Self-respect also implies respect for others. It creates tolerance for that which needs to be tolerated and creates righteous anger against that which is intolerable. If you have taught your children, by both example and precept, self-respect, then you have armored them and given them the tool they need to boost their self-esteem, because they will not sit back and wait for someone else to be responsible for them. They will accept the fact that they are responsible for themselves and that their choices and their job going to school is to learn. To learn what is presented to them, and hopefully to remember it. My friend Bill says something that he never taught his children was to give up, but Common Core seems to have that as its central theme. And it does, in the sense that Common Core and the standards that it wishes to impose upon public schools nationwide deny the fact that human beings are not alike. While giving lip service to the idea that, well, everybody is equal. Well, actually, everybody isn't. In the sense that we are not equally talented, equally bright, equally athletic, equally beautiful, or equally ugly, for that matter. We are all individuals. There are some children going to school whose self-respect will be based on their understanding that they enjoy learning new things and that this is a positive character trait. There are some children who will go to school whose self-respect will be based upon the fact that they understand that treating others with respect, courtesy, kindness is also an excellent character trait, and they know that they can and will do this. No two of us are alike. My friend Bill asks, how do we measure and control desire? We don't. Not with objective, technological, data-driven, statistical, bucolic byproducts, which Common Core depends upon. Because desire, like love, or joy, or grief, or pain, is a highly subjective, personal emotion. We try, those of us who teach, and those of us who parent, and those of us who do both, we try to create an atmosphere, a climate, if you will, in which the desire to know more tomorrow than you did today has room to grow and expand. We try, those of us who parent and those of us who teach and those of us who do both, to set an example of the desire to learn. But the basic creation, if you will, of that desire has to take place in the individual. And it has to take place in childhood by the natural tendency of children to mimic the behavior of the adults around them. And if the behavior of the adults around them shows no desire for a better tomorrow than today through his or her own effort, then the children will not mimic desire for betterment, self-betterment, any more than my cats would mimic me reciting Shakespeare. They'd probably enjoy it, but they certainly wouldn't mimic it. At least I don't think they would. But self-respect isn't always based on academic progress or academic interest. Quite often, self-respect is based on the ability to sustain positive and nourishing relationships. And this is a very fine character trait. It doesn't mean that everybody goes to college, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't mean that everybody makes $150,000 a year at the age of 22 either. It means that if I'm a damned good plumber, I respect myself for the knowledge and expertise and hard work I put into learning my craft. It means if I'm a college professor, I respect myself for the academic knowledge and the time and effort and the writing skills that I have developed in order to offer education to young minds and give them the chance to flower and blossom. Both forms of self-respect are equally viable and equally positive, ladies and gentlemen. And a good education makes both that plumber and that college professor more able to engender self-respect and the desire to learn in their children. Because if the college professor has a young man or young woman in his family who wants to be the very best plumber ever known to man, then that college professor who has self-respect will respect that child's desires, abilities, and encourage and engender as much progress for them to complete their goal as he or she can. And that plumber who has a son or a daughter who wants to go to medical school and becomes the world's greatest ophthalmological surgeon will do the same thing. Not because the plumber wants to be a surgeon or the college professor wants to be a plumber, but because both understand that self-respect derives in a great measure from doing the best you can with what you have. This self-respect, ladies and gentlemen, should be in your children's backpack when they go to school on that first day in September or August if your schools start earlier. Along with the desire to learn, those two things are your basics. Those will take them farther than the very best notebook with the most neat cover and the coolest, most expensive iPhone or whatever technological device it is that you've gone into debt to buy for them. If you can put the desire to learn and self-respect in that child's mental and emotional backpack when you send them out to the bus or drop them off at school on that first morning, you have done a fine job, ladies and gentlemen. Doesn't mean you can quit, and it doesn't mean it's over, but you have started them out in the right way. There are some things that our teachers and our administrators and our parents also need to purchase for their back-to-school experience. Parents need to stop by the emotional drugstore and purchase, with whatever coin they can, a very large jar of patience. Because many parents don't have much. And that lack of patience, the willingness to sit down and take the time necessary to find out what your child's school experience is like, not just by a report card or a test, but by talking with and listening to them, will help you to spot trouble before it results in permanent damage. Uh, Another thing parents need to pick up at that emotional drugstore is a good supply of public schools belong to me pills. Public schools are just that, public. And guess who the public is, folks? We are. If we do not take part in our public schools, whether we have children in them or not, then we will get the schools we deserve. Our lack of interest, our apathy, our willingness to hand over immature souls to Lord knows who without paying a bit of attention to how they're being run, what they're working on, how they're being taught, the effect it has on not just our kid but other kids, then we have no right to complain about the fact that little Junior, after 12 years of public school, can't manage to last longer than 10 minutes in any further education and can't get a job. Or if he can, he can't keep it for longer than 10 minutes. So parents out there doing your back-to-school shopping, make sure you look for those "our public schools belong to us" pills. And that nice big jar of patience. Because you're not going to be able to sit in the classroom and watch what your kids are learning and how it's being taught to them. Any more than the visit by the principal to the classroom to evaluate the teacher is going to say a blessed thing about how well or badly that teacher performs in class. Because even now, ladies and gentlemen, as relatively undisciplined as school classrooms are, if the principal's sitting in the back of the room, every kid in the room knows it, and every kid in the room is going to be on his or her best behavior purely and simply because they don't necessarily want a bad phone call or a bad note to go home. There are exceptions. The behaviorally deranged with an IEP who can behave like idiots no matter where they are, and they will undoubtedly do something disruptive because they always do, but we must summon up our compassion and accept the fact that they too are entitled to a free, appropriate public education, and if it disrupts class, well, that will just teach the other students how to be compassionate to those with difficulties. But in general, the principal's visit in the back of the classroom really does not serve to give him or her a clear idea of what goes on in there on a day-to-day basis. And personally, I am not in favor of closed-circuit television in any classroom. We have enough Big Brother already. And it's not because I think that all teachers are the reincarnation of Mother Teresa or the Virgin Mary or Saint Peter or any other holy individual, but simply because you cannot conveniently or comfortably live in any society where everyone is continually under surveillance 24/7 and cannot be allowed to do or say anything outside the manifesto, which is pretty much what Common Core is starting to try to impose. But teachers are out buying supplies for their classrooms. They pretty much have to because public schools spend a great deal of money on all kinds of things, but school supplies for individual classrooms, no. That's usually the teacher's responsibility. And generally they run out of things before the end of the first semester, so now we take great pride in filling our carts full of Kleenex and notebook paper and extra pencils and rulers and erasers and posters and bookmarks and, you know, anything and everything else we can think of. The teacher shopping cart contains some of the same items that the parent shopping cart does, in that the very large jar of patience has to be multiplied by about 30 for teachers, because parents generally need the large jar if they have 1, 2, 3, 4 children. Teachers need at that times 30 because that's usually close to how many they have in every classroom, 6 or 7 periods a day. And it is difficult to summon, ladies and gentlemen, the kind of patience needed to deal with a modern classroom. It is also difficult to summon the kind of patience needed in today's public education system to deal with a bureaucracy run mad, which is pretty much what they've got to deal with. My friend Rod in the chat room says that most teachers are good people and want to teach, but just one bad apple can spoil the barrel, and now the barrel stinks, and he's quite correct. Most of the teachers with whom I work are superlative at their jobs. They are passionate about them. They love what they do. The biggest thrill in their lives, aside from their own families, is that light bulb going off over the head of a student who just didn't get it, and then all of a sudden, it comes through. And that, as my father used to say, makes us walk about 10 feet off the deck coming home at the end of the day. But because there are people who enter the teaching profession, assuming that it is easy work, and that the only thing you have to do is to keep reasonable order and refrain from either physically assaulting or sexually molesting your students, and many of them don't refrain from either of those, but if you can manage to get by without doing that, so that you get tenure, then you are safe and comfortable and your retirement is assured, and after 20 years or so, if you go into the profession early, you can take a second career with a nice, comfortable retirement benefit and become hopefully comparatively wealthy, and I say comparatively because you certainly aren't on your salary as a teacher. Now, the ones who think it is easy work are few and far between, and most of those don't usually last long enough to get tenure. There are some who do, who are very good at being what they used to call in the 1940s Army as a sad sack, the kind of guy who can get out of all of the onerous duty with a convenient backache or chatting up the sergeant or making sure he knew the best place to get illegal liquor off base and all this kind of other stuff. But part of the reasons that we have the situation we do is that a lot of teachers, really, really good teachers, believe that the system of tenure is owed to them because of what they have to put up with in order to last long enough in today's classrooms to be able to obtain it. And unless you've been in one of today's classrooms, you have no idea what it's like, ladies and gentlemen, particularly with some of the aspects of what is called inquiry-based learning. I won't go into a lot of detail about inquiry-based learning, but you can look it up online and find several different websites that explain it and what it entails and so on and so forth. But one of the aspects of inquiry-based learning is basically having the students control the learning environment and the teacher as the moderator or facilitator. The old study group concept and the self, the peer tutoring concept on projects and that kind of thing is probably closest to what they're talking about. Inquiry-based learning is very much about the quote-unquote child-centered classroom, which was intended to mean the classroom that centered around the child and the child's willingness and opportunity to learn, which has come to be interpreted as the kids need to be in control of their own learning, and that will make them learn more and better, which only works if you fill their backpacks with the self-esteem and the desire to learn before they get to school. It's a little crazy. It's educational theory based on studies and papers and this, that, and the other, published in the late 1980s and early 1990s, at the when the progressive view of education had finally gotten not just its toehold, but its firm foundation, both feet planted and dirt around the roots of the tree, and it was flourishing, as does the Green Bay, to be biblical about it, that basically said that all children just need to be encouraged by the teacher and they'll learn on their own. This philosophy, for lack of a better term, although I hate to dignify it by that, because it makes Socrates and Plato, even though they were wrong, into much less the brilliant thinkers they actually were. But anyway, this educational philosophy makes the assumption that children just can't wait to design their own assignments and help each other to get good grades and teach each other things and so on and so forth. I have been in classrooms where this happy little method of teaching is used. All I can say is that when I got home at the end of the day, the first thing I wanted was a very strong adult beverage, and the second thing, my husband to put his arms around me and say, "There, there, babe, don't cry." My friend Linda hit the nail on the head. Horse feathers is her comment. They would rather play all day long, seems to her. She's quite right, they would. Children are not adults. Wow, gee, what an amazing concept. Quick, everybody, give me the Nobel Prize for something or other. You know, or at least a Pulitzer. Well, first I have to write it down. Children are not adults. Children do not have the self-control or the socialization skills that adults do. You cannot make a classroom into six different committees of children designing their homework for the night. Children need structure, ladies and gentlemen, because they have not developed the ability to create it for themselves. It is very rare for a child under the age of 18 or so to be able to create a structured environment for him or herself. Those who do usually suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder. Because childhood is not adulthood. The understanding of the need for structure and schedules and timing and compartmentalizing bits and pieces of your day so you accomplish all of the tasks that you have to do is as foreign to childhood as learning Sanskrit is to my cat Monkey, who is lying here with her belly up waiting for me to pet her. Fortunately, I'm bright enough to know that Monkey is not going to all of a sudden develop a talent for Sanskrit, but she will probably purr if I rub her belly and be a very contented pussycat. I'm also well aware that very, very, very few proto-humans under the age of 18 are going to be able to structure their own time productively, because proto-humans under the age of 18 do not have any clue what being productive means. In a free society where children are allowed to be children, productivity is not the main goal of one's day when one is 8 years old. It is, however, the main goal of the progressive ideology that places productivity as the major function of everyone in the holy group. Group think, ladies and gentlemen. The encouraging of group think has been on the agenda for our public schools since the 1930s. And Mr. Dewey. The idea that the only thing that matters is the integrity of the group, and that each member of the group is productive, does his or her particular job so that the group prospers. This is the fundamental behind the whole idea of individual groups working on projects, supposedly helping each other, supposedly researching things, assigning this and assigning that, and you do this part and I'll do that part, with the teacher going around saying, gee, aren't you wonderful? It may very well work in a clone factory, but it's not going to work with American kids who have parents who were not brought up in a communist country. And it probably won't work at all, it'd be even less likely to work than American kids whose parents got the hell out of a communist country and brought them here. The classroom groupthink idea, ladies and gentlemen, is the biggest, next to the children, of course, the biggest user up of the store of patience that teachers have to have. Because remember, teachers are not necessarily in charge of their classroom. They are nominally in charge, the way a department head is nominally in charge of his or her department, but they are not permitted to adjust the curriculum, choose a textbook, spend the amount of time they feel necessary on every aspect of learning when they feel it's necessary. No, they are not. They are under the oversight of school administrators, principals, assistant principals, superintendents, school board, etc. And, of course, the Federal Department of Education, which its tentacles in every aspect of a child's school day, from the cafeteria through the clinic to the office to the school bus, to the contents of the child's lunch bag, which mom will pack when they get home. Teachers do not have the authority, in most cases, to permanently remove a child from the classroom if that child is disruptive or in any fashion threatens the health or well-being of other people in the classroom, especially if that child is determined to have a disability of some sort and that child's parents quite often are receiving disability payments in that child's name. Teachers cannot spend extra time on one aspect of a math class. For example, if the classroom, the vast majority of the students are having difficulty grasping a concept, such as, the need for a common denominator when you add or subtract fractions, and why? Because the state has imposed standards of what will be taught, what will be learned in order to complete a specific year of academic study, and at the end of that year, the students will be measured against those standards to see if they have, number one, achieved what is necessary to go to the next grade, and number two, their teacher has performed his or her job properly and inculcated in their delicate little brains all of the knowledge they are supposed to have in that subject for that chronological year. So that's why the second source of the need for so much extra quantity of patience is administration. Because no matter how dedicated a teacher is, no matter how well they do their job, no matter how passionate they are about learning and about seeing their students learn. There will inevitably be a parent or an administrator who, for whatever reason, feels that one child is being, quote-unquote, discriminated against in some fashion by this evil, nasty, wicked teacher. And this evil, nasty, wicked teacher must be disciplined, or removed, or demoted, or something, suitably punished for hurting the feelings of my child, or not being a viable member of my team for the principal. The other supplies that go in the teacher's personal backpack or shopping cart, in addition to the patients, okay, they too need to purchase some of the public schools belong to us pills. And they probably need a larger dose than the parents do, because the parents generally, when they express an opinion about the way public school runs, are probably not going to lose their employment, but a teacher would be. Teachers are enjoined pretty much by unspoken rules that say they should never, ever, ever, ever say anything negative about anything in their school system. From something as simple as a leaky roof in the corner to real violations of the privacy of their students or their fellow workers. They must always be cheerleaders for their school. So the public schools belong to us pill is very necessary for them, because they are generally citizens of this nation and generally residents of the county, city, principality, municipality in which they teach. Not always, but generally. Especially in rural areas or smaller towns or smaller cities. And even if they were not, they still are residents, if not citizens, in this nation of ours. And what happens in the classroom affects what happens 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road to this nation, this constitutional republic that needs educated and discriminating voters to be able to choose people who are going to make the laws that affect every single one of us. So teachers need to start speaking out. This is the downside, ladies and gentlemen, of the system of tenure. Because believe me, if you don't have tenure, you don't dare say boo to a goose. And even if you have tenure, you're pretty cautious about it, because you don't really want to be nudged into a position where for some reason or another you can't do what you enjoy doing or pretend to do what you don't like and stay employed for a while. Everybody who earns a living understands that you generally don't make disparaging remarks about your boss on national television and expect to get a raise or even maintain your employment. This is common sense. Being a whistleblower is incredibly dangerous, particularly in the current administration. But it's always been dangerous, because we have the instinct to survive. And for the vast majority of us, survival depends upon an income so that we can purchase the means for physical survival: food, clothing, shelter, medical care, transportation, little luxuries, whatever. But we hold educators, teachers, to such quote-unquote high standards that it is amazing that we still elect the venal creatures we do to the halls of Congress. And no, I don't say we should fill the House of Representatives or the Senate with teachers, God forbid. If the usual teachers' meeting went on in the House and or in the Senate, they'd get even less done than they do now. But our teachers in general are not venal. They are not self-serving. They work hard. Their days do not end with the final bell or when busloads are called, because there is not enough time during their day to complete all of the auxiliary work they must do in order to track, record, statisticify the charming little souls that are in their care for 6 or 7 periods a day. But because these teachers still do their jobs, ladies and gentlemen, still pick up those 30 times quantities of patients, and many of them are speaking out, we always have the hope that the new school year will be better than the last one. We've talked about what parents need in their shopping cart, what the kids need in their backpack when they go to school, and what teachers need to purchase from the emotional drugstore. What about administrators? Well, I think one thing that administrators need to find a supply of is backbone. And that is a quantity that is difficult to come by. Because I have watched and heard reports of administrators caving in like jellyfish to absurd demands to treat teachers like scum, because they are terrified of lawsuits. I can understand. It's part of that self-preservation thing. You don't want to be the principal or vice principal who brings a lawsuit on your school system. Believe me, you do not want to, because you will not remain employed. You will be courteously asked to resign. And if you don't courteously say, certainly I'll be happy to, then you will be subject to taking the brunt of the negative consequences of whatever legal proceedings that particular parent wants to apply. Because unfortunately, we have a litigious society, ladies and gentlemen. We have a society in which any time anything goes wrong in people's lives, the first thing they think of is, where's the number of a good lawyer? Who can I blame? I can relate a situation that happened to me. When my husband was dying in the hospital, and I had just returned to the hospital after being phoned, receiving a phone call that said, get here as soon as you can, when everything had been stable an hour before, one of the doctors who was aiding my husband asked me to come out into the corridor of the ICU and said to me, why are we putting all this effort? He's dying. And needless to say, I was not at my most articulate, but I tried to explain to him that I had gone home and an hour and a half before this, and my husband was stable and was receiving antibiotics, and I was called to come right back because he had all of a sudden gone downhill. And the first thing that this doctor said to me is, how dare you say we haven't been taking care of him? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't imply or even think that. But his first response to a woman who was losing her husband was to defensively speak rudely and shortly to her. Out of nothing more complicated than fear. Fear that he, being the physician in charge at that time, he had just come on duty about maybe 15 minutes before I got there, hadn't had time to assess the situation, hadn't had time to look at any information from anybody, talk to anybody, and apparently made the assumption that I had been there the whole time and that somehow or other I could fill him in on the state of my husband's health. Needless to say, I was not particularly happy with that doctor, and I would not be particularly inclined to see him for any medical care for anybody. But I understand what motivated his outburst. And I can empathize with him. Because we have created a climate in this nation that says no one is ever responsible for their own actions. It is always somebody else's fault when something bad happens, and somebody is going to sue somebody to get financial recompense for bad stuff that happened to them. This has filtered down into our school systems, ladies and gentlemen. Administrators do not stand up for their staff because they are terrified that the parent who is complaining is going to sue the school system and likely win, because the federal government has made our public schools unjustifiably responsible for every aspect of a child's life, not just his or her learning, not just his or her ability to attend school, but his or her entire life. Teachers are being told, subliminally and directly, that they must take on the role of parent, grandparent, counselor, educator, coach, life coach, psychologist, psychiatrist, mentor, best friend, every possible thing. That child could be or would be, teachers are being told that they are ultimately responsible for the child's failure or success in every aspect of his life, or her life, as the case may be. Because administrators do not want to even imply that parents have any responsibility or the child has any responsibility at all. And as my friend Linda says, that is the ultimate nanny state, and she is right. We need to remove from our back-to-school shopping carts the idea that the teacher is responsible for your child's willingness to learn. They're not. That's your responsibility. We need to remove from that back-to-school shopping cart the idea that my child is perfect, and if he doesn't get a good grade, it's always the teacher's fault. And we need to remove from our back-to-school backpack, if we are teachers or professionals, that somehow or other we can be Superman or Superwoman, and there is no such thing as kryptonite. And we need, ladies and gentlemen, to remove the federal government from our shopping cart when it comes to education completely, thoroughly, and immediately. The Department of Education needs to be eliminated. Federal funding that comes to states should not be earmarked for anything whatsoever. It should be a blank check, purely and simply because it is at the state level that all of this crap is put upon us. And if the federal government wants to control the states, then that means it wants to control you. Because your state apparatus of government is much more within your reach, and you have much more influence on it than you ever will as an individual against the federal government. Unless you are extraordinarily wealthy, or you make a really, really good speech with a teleprompter. So my particular shopping cart this year, going back to school, is to continue to speak out and to continue to explain as clearly as I can what goes on in our public schools. Now, granted, I cannot be in 50 different states. Yes, I know how many we have. In multiple school systems, multiple classrooms at the same time. I'm good, but I'm not that good, folks. Unlike Superman, I cannot cause the world to spin backward, or unlike Professor McGonagall, I don't have access to a time turner so I can, you know, adjust time and go back and, you know, visit Chicago and then be not lose any time and visit New York and then not lose any time. No, I can't do that. What I can do, however, is to watch what happens nationally, at state level, via news, via websites, via commentary, via blogs, and with my own eyes in our local schools. And I can urge you out there listening and my friends in the chat room to be eyes on your public schools. The reward for your interest and your involvement is not going to be instantaneous, ladies and gentlemen. Any more than sending your child to first grade for the first time, he's not going to come home with a PhD in Outer Mongolian racial derivative cultural classifications either. Education is one of those goods for which the value is not immediately apparent. Educating your child is not going to give them, as I said, a PhD in whatever after 7.5 hours in a classroom. The end results of your child's education will not be visible to you until that child takes his or her place as a functioning adult citizen. That means your involvement is going to be long-term. Just as your child's involvement in educating him or herself is going to be long-term as well. Because what we need to have in our shopping carts when we all go back to school this fall, ladies and gentlemen, is the understanding that the function of an education is to encourage the creation of a lifelong learner. It is not to get a piece of paper that says you're worth X amount of dollars in the job market. You are worth what you can do, what you can learn, and how well you apply it. Your worth is up to you. You will never fulfill it if you are told that you needn't put forth any effort or that it's someone else's job to fulfill your worth for you. we must remove from our shopping cart the encouragement for the entitlement professional victim society. We must not take the everybody gets a trophy because it makes it all of us feel good idea from our backpacks and our school lunchboxes and our briefcases and our lesson plans. Because I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but even children have to understand that you don't always come in first. And they need to understand that because they are children. And yes, we hate to see them cry. We hate to see them disappointed. We hate to see them feel bad about themselves. Of course we do, because they are children. We would like them to be the happy, cherubic, angelic, delightful, laughing little creatures that Victorians always painted on their Christmas cards. I would like to be 5'8", 22, and have a figure to die for, too, and I can't. Because there is no such thing as utopia. There is no such thing as an ideal world. There is no such thing as perfect safety or a risk-free life. And there certainly is no such thing as never, ever, ever failing at anything. We have got to swing the pendulum back to common sense, ladies and gentlemen. 100 years ago, the pendulum had swung so far into the Victorian thinking pattern that children should be seen and not heard and treated a great deal like zoo animals until they were old enough to go out and join the army or attend Oxford or whatever, and taught that they were the superior beings of the world, especially if they were male, and if they were female, that they were to be sweet, ignorant, loving, comfortable baby factories because that was their highest calling. We do not need the pendulum to swing back to Victorian times and Victorian education, ladies and gentlemen, but we certainly do not need it swung as far to the left as it has gone in the last 30 years. I am absolutely thrilled that if a woman believes that she would make an excellent combat soldier, she's given leave to try. But I am not thrilled with the idea of telling a woman that, sure, you can be a combat soldier and we'll make sure those nasty bullets don't hit you because you're a girl. You can't have heaven on earth, ladies and gentlemen. You can't have it through any religious belief system, and you sure as shooting cannot have it through government. Because government is the best developer of hell on earth that I know of. Purely and simply because it is deluded enough in its membership to think that it can, by regulation and the threat of force, create heaven on earth. The Icarus Syndrome. On a cloudy day, pretty much defines our current governmental philosophy. The sun has not come out and melted the wax attaching their wings yet. But the clouds are beginning to dissipate, and more and more and more of us are encouraging the sunlight, paying attention to the fact that, guess what? Government can't make life perfect for you. We have a caller, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm thinking that's my friend Linda. Hello, Linda.
Hello, can you hear me?
I sure can, darling. How are you this evening?
Hanging in there. It's a gorgeous day. You know, it's funny when you talk about the government, because I had put in the chat room earlier that the government produces nothing, it has nothing, it has no money, it's, you know.
Exactly
all it does
correct.
At this point, when you're talking about Icarus, I'm like, oh, give me the sun, give me the sun.
Well, sweetheart, I tell you, Dawn, you're doing your all to shine light. You're my favorite little sun out there in the far west, and you're not setting anytime soon.
Let's hope not. You know, because what they, especially under the current regime, as you stated, they're because of who they are, you know, and what they are, other than being able to print the money, you see, and of course the Obama bots would never understand that the government really doesn't have any money other than what they
steal.
No, they
don't. All they wouldn't know. All the government has is the promise of money. They have the
promise of money.
That's it.
And what they do create is misery, as you can see.
Exactly.
And what it's really sad that the people just, I mean, they just don't understand any of it. And, of course, if I mentioned the word Frederick Bastiat, they think I was speaking, you know, Martian. But what happened today on the very tail end of Glenn's show, and I don't know if you caught it, but David Barton,
part
of it's going to be a whole hour tomorrow on Common Core and how they're fighting it. And he says the people that are waking up, because the parents now, they're seeing the curriculum and they're seeing it for what it is, and they ain't happy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're fighting. And see, this is how, this is the only way you're going to get their attention is, you know, let the brick wall fall on the head. You know?
Yep.
Finally, they wake up. But
well, you have to.
So
the thing is, as I said last week, government only power is the power of force. The the option to force you to do something by punishing you if you don't do it in some form, material, etc.
Whether you want to or not, right.
And the revolutionary ideas of our founding fathers, literally revolutionary ideas, that the people were a force equal to and superior to government, is what our people are forgetting. They're forgetting
they
the fact that that it was, this was not a nation based on the inalienable right to be governed. It was based on the inalienable right to get rid of the freaking government if it was not doing a decent job.
Exactly.
And but too many people in our slavish adherence to political correctness, and God forbid I should appear to be intolerant of anybody. Well, I am awfully sick and tired of that, too, because there are certain things. If you look at the medical definition of tolerance, it means the physical ability to imbibe something and not have it make you sick. Well, I don't have any tolerance anymore for the current government because it is making me sick, and I don't want to swallow any more of it.
And what they were talking about today is exactly correct. The local efforts, going to one's school board and to one's principal, et cetera, and having a group of parents saying, no, we're not going to have this curriculum on our children, you know, because you can't even reach, like where I live, you can't get to Sacramento, even if you had a private jet, for God's sakes. You don't have the lobbyist type money. They don't care. They've run a lot, just like the rest. You can't get to the Washington, D.C. You must, in the long term, that local effort is going to pay off big for the parents. You stop it in the nip it in the bud in your own neighborhood, and every neighborhood has to follow suit. And then
it has
Then you can do it. That's the only way to fight this.
It is, and that's why I'm trying to get people to understand that the theme music I use to start this show is perfect, Linda, because that's what I try to teach the students I work with. You are this country. Not everybody is a college professor. Not everybody is a freaking football player. But everybody is a human being who has talents and skills that they can contribute to the good of everyone. Not because they are forced to by being locked in a tiny little box that government says you fit in, but because
it's
they desire
free association. Right.
Yes.
The freedom of choice, all that. Free market, free association.
Yes. The idea that you can think outside the box is, you know, I think one of the hotel chains uses it in their commercials, for heaven's sake, which I find hilarious since what they're trying to do is convince you to think inside their particular hotel box. But anyway, they're having fun. So, and I do get a chuckle out of the commercial every now and again. But I think this time of year, when all the kids are getting ready to go back to school, parents are breathing sighs of relief, thinking, oh, thank God, you know, at least this way they're out of the house for 7.5 hours and maybe I can get their bedrooms clean for the first time in 3 months. Or mom is thinking, oh, goody, less daycare funds to spend, you know, that kind of stuff. I understand
right.
the desire for material success, and I don't fault anybody, male or female, for wanting to be a productive citizen in the sense of earning a salary, having your work compensated, feeling of value because you can do a job that is worth somebody paying you. But I do think that if you're going to produce babies that are going to become, hopefully, live long enough to become mm-hmm. adults, then you have a responsibility to pay attention to what it is they're learning when they're not with you.
Oh, my goodness. And when you, you know, it's funny because, of course, I was a child of an educator professionally, and his idea was the more you could go and avail yourself of knowledge, whether it's in high school or college, the more doors are open for you in your mind. Thereby,
exactly.
when you choose to say, oh, I'm going to put my feet in the water in this particular thing, and once you try it on, and you, again, the field is wide open for you. Then your options are open. You
mm-hmm.
As a youngster, you don't even sometimes know what you want to be when you grow up.
Very few people do, because children are bundles of unknown potential. Lord
yes.
knows, I've been in the profession of educating people for 40 years now, on and off, and in different venues.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the kids that I thought were going to wind up in jail have turned out to be decent, honest, hardworking parents of really
cool.
nice kids. And it
Great.
Happens. But they were given the opportunity to discover that, yeah, I can do this. Not because
right.
somebody gave it to me, but because I worked my delicate little derriere off and I figured it
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
That's why the self-esteem business, nobody can give that to you. Self-respect,
no,
your parents can teach you. But self-esteem, you have to earn.
Well, it's definitely, it's earned by putting forth effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my mother's was always a stickler on that. And my dad was one to make sure that we had the tools to get to
mm-hmm.
where we needed to go, whether it was to learn how to comprehend reading better or little tricks for
mm-hmm.
math, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
it
yep.
was made available. As long as we put forth the effort and we didn't, you know, slide off on our homework and do bad things, I mean, we knew that was our job, that we, you know, and you do not
that
watch TV at H or high water. You did not do that until that assignment was finished. You know,
exactly.
although and kids, you know, kids are kids. They want to play and they want to watch TV. And I remember listening to I Love Lucy. You know,
yeah.
after I got bored of reading half the chapter, and I'd listen to it, and then when the commercial came back on, and I was stuck in my room,
mm-hmm.
but I could hear
yep.
it through the wall. So,
course,
you know, but I did get
course.
The stuff done, but I wasn't allowed to go see it. Darn it! But you know,
yeah.
I had a pretty strict upbringing in that sense. It wasn't Victorian, like
mm-hmm.
you said. Thank God, because my
yeah.
mother thought that was a little bit much as well.
Well, so did mine.
but what they're doing now with Common Core is hideous. This is
it's insane.
This is of course you are an educated woman. If you, as a general speaking, cannot understand that this is right out of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx, then you have not been paying attention at all.
No,
this
and they don't.
Is evil.
The people who are touting this, the people who are manipulating parents into believing it's a good idea, know that the parents they're manipulating have been indoctrinated by this crap
yes.
for 30 years.
Exactly.
These are the people whose kids are in the primary grades now. They don't see anything wrong with it. Oh, look at me, how well I turned out. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Oh, God.
You elect that thing.
Thing. I know.
Yes, I'm a lady.
Yes,
I do not use pejoratives. I guess I'm too egotistical to want to demean myself by using four-letter words. They always spark to me a lack of imagination. Things serve. But I guess for me, as I look ahead to going back to school, and our schools here start
mm-hmm.
on the day after Labor Day, but I have in-service days and convocation and all that
right.
other stuff next week. The propensity for these kids to think that everybody owes them something they haven't worked for, that somehow or other
awful.
I and every other educator out there is magic, and all they have to do is sit there and, you know, look at you, and all of a sudden they will automatically learn things, and they get that from their parents. Their parents basically make the assumption. And the funny part is, when I was talking earlier about the college professor who might have a great plumber in his family, or the plumber who has the next ophthalmic surgeon, my parents, neither of them were college educated. My dad took whatever college course he could get the company to pay for, because mm-hmm. he didn't make a lot of money, but he was an incredibly well-educated, self-educated man. My mother was a high school graduate, but both of them told and taught by example and by precept, all three of us, myself and my two sisters, that the value of knowledge was knowledge, not you can be rich or you can be this or you'll get a better job if you do this. It was the more you know, the more opportunities you have.
You have.
Knowledge
absolutely.
Is worth something for its own sake. And both of them
exactly.
were thrilled to death that I wanted to go to college. My middle sister did not. And they were not necessarily happy about that, because to them, they wanted us to have an opportunity that neither of them had. But they didn't ostracize
sure.
her or call her stupid, because that was not her bent.
No.
They were thrilled
right.
that she wound up getting married and having two beautiful, intelligent kids. My niece and nephew were great people. And I have great nieces, or grandniece, and two grandnephews as well. So for my sister, being a wife and a mother and so on, that was her goal, and she was good at it. For my other
awesome.
Sister and for me, no. So, but
I know.
Both my parents understood that how to inculcate self-respect. They understood that it
right.
wasn't about us meeting their expectations of, I want you in this box, and you in that box.
Right.
It was meeting their expectations of, I want you to be the very best Terry Rowland or Terry Swanson, which was my maiden name, or the best
yeah.
Christine Swanson or the best Elizabeth Swanson you could be. Well, no matter whether that was being the very best stenographer, the very best mother, or the very best airline stewardess, it didn't matter. What mattered to them was that we understand that the goals we
sure.
had could be achieved by learning.
Yeah.
And putting forth the effort to learn more. And if
and
I can model that.
I know. What they're doing when you talk about, and this is the, I'm sure this makes you cringe every time you hear it, is the, you know, that everybody gets the trophy for showing up and there needs to be
yeah.
no effort put forth. And it's like, let's redistribute the grades. I mean, that's basically what they're doing, in essence, you know, that you just for showing up, you get this trophy, which is nonsense. And what they're doing is cultivating the old Soviet model of statism, whereby
mm-hmm.
when you nationalize the farming industry and you kick off the real guys, and then and everybody gets paid the same, and you
mm-hmm.
see the results of that. Oh well, no, thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Exactly.
You can keep that, but people don't
mm-hmm.
know history, Terry. So this is why they're falling into this trap, and
exactly,
they don't know
Because it has not been taught to them. We have tilted so far over into the politically correct
mm-hmm.
idiocy of there is no bad behavior, only communication we don't understand. There is no right or wrong. There is only let's be tolerant of everything. No, there are some things for which I have absolutely no tolerance. Well, alcohol happens to be one of them, because physically I just can't do it. So I don't. You know, I'm smart enough to know that I don't enjoy throwing up for 4 hours. But this nonsense that our kids are being fed, that somehow or other everyone has the same potential for greatness. No, we don't. We have the same potential to be the greatest us that it is
yes,
in our power to be.
And then on the other hand, they're dumbing them down and making the standards
mm-hmm.
so horrible. It's like, oh my, it's the antithesis of everything, of the founding
mm-hmm.
and everything that you and I came up with. I mean, and
exactly.
our parents came up with.
Because
oh my
they
God.
Do not, it used to be, we were encouraged, I was when I was in school, and I'm pretty sure you were too, to think that being a leader was a good thing. And that being a
yes.
leader meant that you showed your leadership qualities by working hard and so on and so forth. But progressives
right.
don't want to inculcate leaders. Leaders will topple their power base.
Right.
You can't
because they need
teach
people.
Children. That's right. They need sheep. They need cogs in the machine. You do not want to hold up great leaders as role models. You can't do that, because then these kids might want to emulate somebody like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson.
Oh my God, absolutely.
You know what would happen to the Oval Office right now, don't you, if either one of those gentlemen walked in?
Yeah. There would be rails and feathers.
Yes.
Much of it.
And a very large cauldron of tar on the front lawn.
They would be raiding the ostrich farms as we speak.
Oh, my God, wouldn't they? But you can't teach children to be exceptional. You can only give them a climate in which, if they are exceptional, they can blossom. But this whole idea that it's so absurd, it's oxymoronic. You're exceptional because you're just like everybody else. I beg your pardon?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
None of it. No, it never has. But fortunately, we have a generation of kids who have been brought up on sound bites, who've been brought up on pretty speeches, who've been brought up in, oh, yes, you're so wonderful and we all love you. No, we don't. You're a nasty little brat. You know, I'm sorry. And I went through that with the kid that I worked with. There were times when he was a nasty little brat. And every single time the guys go, oh, but everybody loves you. No, they don't. I'm sorry. Oh, buddy, that will not be the case. Ever, as long as you live. The assumption that somehow or other we can all sit down and sing Kumbaya together and have instant world peace belongs in a Miss America contest. It doesn't belong
it's
in
crazy.
Government or in school. It's nonsense.
Right.
It's garbage, and unfortunately there are way too many people who have gone through the indoctrination of the last 30 years in our progressive education system who are buying into it because this is what they have been taught is true. That if we all just sit down and be nice to each other, nobody will ever hurt anybody. And if we just make enough laws against all these things, nobody will ever do it.
Yeah,
well, as far as I know, the Ten Commandments have been around for a very, very long time, and they certainly haven't stamped out adultery. They haven't stamped out profanity. They have not stamped out coveting anything, killing, bearing false witness. If just making a law, particularly when it comes directly from, you know, I am who I am, do it, I doubt very much whether the government is capable of doing it either.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call, and I'm going to go back to the chat room, and you're doing a great job. Love your shows.
Well, thank
and
you,
God bless.
Sweetheart. Appreciate it. Bless you too, sweetie. Thanks for calling, Linda.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye, darling. My favorite California bird of paradise, Miss Linda Sills, whose show is on every Wednesday night. I'll give her a promo too, right from the left coast, Wednesday evenings at 7. Be sure and tune in, ladies and gentlemen, and get a good taste of Miss Linda Sills. Like I said, she's one of those suns, those sources of the sunlight that I admire and honor, and one of my heroes. I think that there are a lot of you out there, ladies and gentlemen, who believe passionately in the idea that the source of all progress and all good things comes from the individual mind and heart and not from government. And that individual mind and heart comes from God, definitely not from government. Passing more laws, creating more standards, regulating this, prohibiting that, generally does not eradicate behavior that is antisocial. It merely makes that behavior less profitable for those who engage in it. You cannot turn everyone into Mother Teresa or Albert Einstein or Luciano Pavarotti or Mao Zedong, for that matter, simply by regulating it and by creating the groupthink Borg society that progressives would like to see in place in our nation. I will continue to run my mouth. For those of you who are tired of it, you always have the option, thank God, of not listening in. And for those of you who aren't, I'll be back again next Thursday at the usual time, 6 p.m., right here on Blog Talk Radio. And again, I urge you to visit our website and talk with and exchange ideas with and concerns with people who believe that you are the nation as they are. And on this back-to-school month, make sure that your child's shopping cart is filled with self and the understanding that learning is a joy and something that no one can ever take from them. As always, all my love to my greatest fan, and bless you all. Thank you to all the folks in the chat room, Doc and Bill and Linda and Rod, for joining me tonight, and all of you out there in the listening audience. Have a great back-to-school year, and see you next week. Blessed be everyone.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.